Welcome back to another episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, featuring none other than your charismatic and wonderful co-host, Dr. Joshua Hurwitz, and my good friend sitting across the road from me, well, sitting across the room from me, Dr. Michael William, Leonardo DiCaprio, Keanu Reeves, Anderson, Leonardo DiCaprio, Fernando. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for revealing my true full legal name, which has not one but two Leonardo DiCaprio middle names.
You really love Leonardo DiCaprio.
My parents did, apparently, in Josh's mind.
But today we have an absolutely interesting episode for you, like all our episodes. We're looking at targeted non-small cell lung cancer. We're talking about the adjuvant in the non-small cell lung cancer space with ALK mutated lung cancer and the neoadjuvant for EGFR mutated lung cancer, which is going to be quite interesting. Two different approaches, who will win, two different types and biologies of cancers, but just a really interesting discussion that I'm excited about. Just to give context, when people have resected lung cancer, there's a really high risk of recurrence, up to 70% in some cases for sort of stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, and sometimes we usually quote about 40 to 50%. And so the question is, in these cohort of patients, what do you do? Adjuvant chemotherapy doesn't really do that much. I think the quotation is about 5% benefit. And even in the neoadjuvant space doesn't do that much. But I'll hand over the reins to Dr. Michael, Leonardo DiCaprio, Fernando today, who is always a tour de force. What do you have in store for us?
Josh is reaching deep into his bag of tricks and idioms today. So you're absolutely right, Josh. The space of early lung cancer is evolving rapidly. And not to go on too much of a tangent, even because we've just started, but hopefully it's going to become a much bigger part of our practice, because in Australia, at least, there's recently been funding for a low-dose CT screening program. So the hope will be that rather than us picking up these early lung cancers by accident when we're looking for something else, obviously the majority of lung cancers are diagnosed late, and the early lung cancers are frequently diagnosed when we're looking for something else. So with a screening program, hopefully that translates into a greater proportion of people being diagnosed early in a manageable stage. But of course, that means nothing if we don't have approaches to this. So for early lung cancer, it is becoming increasingly critical, right before we even get into the trials, that you get full genomic and mutation status of the lung cancer before surgery, before any sort of therapeutic approach is taken, because therapeutic approaches are changing in the early lung cancer space, and they will be continuing to change in the future. So we know that for patients without a mutation, without a driver mutation, neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy, as per CheckMate 816, amongst others, is the standard now. And the benefits of that are obvious. You can downstage the tumor. You can potentially change treatment from just definitive chemo radiotherapy followed by durvalumab, which is, you know, not a great treatment, but for a long time it was all we had, to a resection followed by adjuvant chemotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy of some description. So we are actually changing management with these neoadjuvant trials. However, the evidence is still a little bit murky in those patients with driver mutations. And the largest body of evidence that we have is the study that I'm going to talk about. It only took me about 20 minutes to get there, but it is the NEOS trial, N-E-O-S, which is a multicenter, single-arm, open-label, phase 2b trial using osimertinib as neoadjuvant therapy in patients with EGFR mutant, resectable stage 2 to 3b lung adenocarcinoma. I don't think we need to go too much into the background. We're very familiar with osimertinib at the moment, and Josh has already given a lovely, concise overview, which is something we never say on this podcast, concise, about early lung cancer and the benefits or lack thereof of neoadjuvant and adjuvant chemotherapy. The evidence for neoadjuvant osimertinib is at this point limited to smaller phase 2 trials. So the phase 2 emerging CTONG1103 trial didn't actually use osimertinib. It used erlotinib compared with gemcitabine plus cisplatin as neoadjuvant therapy. It failed to meet the objective response rate endpoint with a non-statistically significant but numerical benefit of erlotinib over chemotherapy. And there was also a similar overall survival. The phase 2 ASCENT trial reported the results of neoadjuvant afatinib in patients with stage 3 EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer with an overall response rate of 58%, but only enrolled 19 patients. So
not a lot you can take from that.
And also, Josh, I don't know about you, but I think I've seen afatinib used once or twice in clinical practice. Don't really know where its niche is, but if it has a niche at all, it's relatively small.
And the other thing, erlotinib is very much a previous generation TKI. So using that and as the standard of care is not something that we would do here in Australia.
Exactly. It's pretty much a dinosaur of a drug, I think, these days. You'd only really use it if someone had unacceptable toxicity from a later generation.
Which so far is not the case.
It's not really the case. So NEOS, as I mentioned, was a single-arm, open-label phase 2B trial, which was performed at 6 centres in mainland China. Patients were eligible if they were aged between 18 and 75 years, had histologically or cytologically confirmed lung adenocarcinoma, and their disease stage had to be 2A, 2B, 3A or 3B with a T score of 3 to 4, nodal score of 2 in those patients with stage 3B disease. They had to have an EGFR mutation, and obviously, as with all of these trials, it's either the exon 19 deletion or the exon 21 L858R mutation. So exon 20, which we've talked about in previous episodes, is excluded. They had to have an ECOG performance status of 0 to 1, and key exclusion criteria included other anti-cancer treatments or uncontrolled systemic diseases, so fairly standard stuff. The primary endpoint was overall response rate, which was defined as the proportion of patients who had a complete response or a partial response according to RECIST after 6 weeks of neoadjuvant treatment of osimertinib. Interestingly as well, in addition to the 6 weeks of neoadjuvant treatment, patients then received 3 years of adjuvant osimertinib based on the evidence of ADAURA. So it's not just neoadjuvant and then nothing, it's neoadjuvant and then adjuvant, so it's almost perioperative.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sandwich approach. That's a very interesting concept because it's difficult to say whether you'll talk about this, and I just really want to dig in on that.
I'm making eyes at Josh saying don't spoil my
but I want to
reveal. But no, you're absolutely right, because and this will be a big discussion point. This is a very interesting trial, and it's a very interesting approach. I do like that they've used the ADAURA because it means that for enrolling of patients, we know they're not missing out on therapy that's known to be effective. However, it does muddy the waters a bit, as you said. So still a relatively small trial, larger than the other ones we mentioned before, but still small with 40 patients enrolled. Among the 40 participants, the median age was 63 years old. 25 patients, so that's 62.5% of patients, were female, and 8 participants had a performance status of 1, that's 20%. So fairly standard for our EGFR mutant cohorts. 12.5% of patients, that's 5 out of 40, I should just use the numbers here, were diagnosed with stage 2A, 29 out of 40 patients with stage 2B, 22 had stage 3A and 10 had stage 3B. It's interesting as well, Josh, and I know you'll speak about ALENA and this will be a point in yours, but they don't include patients with stage 1B lung cancer, which, as we've seen in ADAURA, and spoiler alert, we will see in ALENA.
Oh, wow. I see what you did
there. Yeah, two can play at this game. The benefit of targeted therapy over surgery alone remains a little bit nebulous. So those patients were not included in this study. 38 out of 40 patients completed the 6-week neoadjuvant osimertinib therapy. The two who discontinued did so due to consent withdrawal. Of all 38 participants, and now we're getting into the juicy part here, 27 out of 38 achieved a partial response and 11 had stable disease. This is, again, according to RESIST. The overall response rate was 71.1% and the disease control rate was 100%, which is pretty good. And you look at the waterfall plot, and many waterfall plots, as anyone who's looked at one will see, frequently the twist, what I call the twist, where the positive readings actually become negative, happens around the middle of the plot. This is one of those plots where it's just all, with the exception of one patient, it's all downwards. So with the exception of one patient, everyone has had some measure of disease response.
This is great. What are we going to do with this podcast when every trial is like, well, this is really good?
Well, that'll be great, because we'll just have so much positive vibes rather than the occasional cynicism and
skepticism,
existential crisis that we currently have. So please, smart people of the world, please do that for us.
Positive vibes.
Positive vibes, yeah. Well, this is the secret now. It's just turned into the secret, just manifesting positive vibes. 32 patients underwent surgery out of the 38 that completed their neoadjuvant osimertinib. Six patients did not undergo surgical resection. Four of those refused surgery. One had an adverse event and one was deemed too high risk for surgery. Of the 32 participants who underwent surgery, 16 underwent VATS and 16 underwent open thoracotomy. An R0 resection, which was one of the secondary endpoints, was achieved in 30 out of 32 patients. So that's pretty good. And an R2 resection was received in the remaining two. In addition, 10% of the 28 patients who had pathological evaluable disease achieved a major pathological response, including one who had a complete response. 46% of patients, 13 out of the 28, had a pathological response of greater than 50%, so a 50% shrinkage in tumor burden.
Wonderful.
And that's again shown in the waterfall. In the waterfall plot, downstaging occurred in 15 of 32 patients. This is something that I was particularly interested in, because the big benefit of neoadjuvant therapy is changing those patients from unresectable to resectable.
Yeah.
So 7 of the 17 resected patients who had N2 disease at baseline experienced downstaging to N1 or N0 after neoadjuvant osimertinib. So that's that. Really, really good pathological responses at surgery. During neoadjuvant treatment, 82% of patients, 33 out of 40, had adverse events. The most common were fairly standard stuff: rash, diarrhea, mucositis, dry skin, decreased appetite. The most common grade 3 adverse event was rash with one person. So as we've seen with
that's just amazing.
With a significant body of evidence, osimertinib is pretty well tolerated.
Yeah, it's a good time to be a lung oncologist.
It is. And for a lot of the more veteran lung oncologists, you might say not before time, because they were in the dark ages for a long time.
That's it.
So that's NEOS in a nutshell, but there are a lot of discussion points to be had. And the first I will say is the study design. So it's important to note that this is a single arm phase 2 study with no comparator arm. Four patients, a small number of patients from a single population, from those in mainland China. Now, China is an incredibly diverse country with lots of linguistic and cultural stuff, but it's still probably a handful of ethnic groups. Certainly can't extrapolate these results reliably to people of other ethnic groups necessarily.
Or even the wider Chinese population.
Or even the wider Chinese population. You're exactly right. So difficulty with extrapolating, with no comparator arm, and that means no p-values, no hazard ratio. So we don't know how significant the numerical results we have here are. The other thing, as Josh rudely spoiled for me before, is the use
so bitter,
of,
so bitter.
So bitter, that's why I torpedoed your study as well, was the use of adjuvant osimertinib, which has its benefits in terms of ethical enrollment of patients. You're not denying them treatment that
standard
is known
care.
You're not denying them standard of care, exactly. But we don't know how much benefit in terms of overall survival and event-free survival of which it's worth noting weren't outcomes in this study, which is the next point I'll come to. We don't know how much of that is going to be, if we ever get that data, the due to the adjuvant osimertinib or the neoadjuvant osimertinib. We don't know which one's better. It would be ideal to have, at some point down the track, a trial comparing neoadjuvant and adjuvant by itself. But
I was actually thinking that exact same thing. Like, why don't we just redo the trial, make it multinational, do a neoadjuvant adjuvant sandwich versus the standard adjuvant?
This is what Josh is going to do when he gets his infinite money.
Infinite money.
Yeah, he's just going to buy all of the osimertinib and conduct a trial.
All of the drugs.
So that's an issue. And as I mentioned before, we don't have event-free and overall survival for this study. Now, they do acknowledge this. They note that pathological outcomes are thought to be correlative with survival outcomes in the early lung cancer space, but unlike the breast cancer space, these have not been validated. So, and this is largely due to the fact that, as Josh said at the start, lung cancer is notorious for recurring. For people with stage 3B lung cancer, the five-year overall survival rate is about 26%. So you're looking at more than 75%, more than three-quarters of patients will recur and die within 5 years.
Terrible, terrible.
So we know that this treatment appears to work. I shouldn't say we know. This treatment appears to work up to and including the time of surgery. Anything after that remains a bit of an unknown. And I'll stop here, Josh, just with one final glimpse into the future, because we've talked about how futuristic our podcast is. This is an interesting study, a very interesting study, but it's a bit of an appetizer. It's a bit of a warm-up act, because coming soon is the Phase 3 NeoAdora study. And that is a study of neoadjuvant osimertinib with or without chemotherapy compared to chemotherapy alone. And that will have data eventually for event-free survival and overall survival. So neoadjuvant osimertinib is almost certainly coming, but the evidence is still not quite there yet from NEOS. Hopefully NeoAdora will be coming at some point this year if you look at the AstraZeneca website. But I think that will be much more performative in terms of the benefits of neoadjuvant osimertinib.
And of course, it's going to add to the difficulty in figuring out how to treat your patients when you've got a new adjuvant study. Do they have the adjuvant arm on that one as well?
So yes, they do have adjuvant treatment, but it is investigator choice. Now, Obviously, based on ADORA, the optimal choice is going to be osimertinib. So you would assume that the vast majority of people are going to get osimertinib post-surgery, But that will be an interesting breakdown to see who gets chemo, who gets nothing.
Fascinating, Mark. It's actually fascinating, because if you downstage someone, do you then give them adjuvant therapy based on their original, which is what you'd probably do, but there's just so many questions, so many unknowns.
Exactly. If you have an R0 resection, as 30 out of 32 patients did in NEOS, does that then spare them 3 years of osimertinib, which is not only a toxicity benefit to the patient, but a financial benefit as well? Mm-hmm. We've talked about financial toxicity multiple times on this show. And if we can reduce the amount of treatment that people need, the better. That's never a bad thing.
Well, Michael, why don't we jump across? Would you be happy with that?
No. Okay. I want to keep talking for the next. No, of course. Let's jump across. We've talked about neoadjuvant. We've segued into adjuvant, but let's twist things a bit. Go off the EGFR gravy train and then jump on to ALK, which is basically EGFR, but like 3 or 5 years later.
That's exactly right. And before I do that, Michael, I did want to flag something with our listeners. We're about to launch a newsletter coming soon to an inbox near you. Feel free to subscribe on our website or shoot us an email. We're really excited for this. It's something Michael and I have been working on for a while, and it's up for the Booker Prize, the National Book Award, the Nobel Literature Award.
Josh has just Googled a bunch of literature awards and is now reading them out.
Miles Franklin, Nebula, the best one is a Nigeria Prize for Literature, let's be really honest.
It's also for the Hugo Award for Science Fiction.
It is, and the Orwell Prize.
Yeah, exactly. It's up for all of those. So if you want to get in on this, we are as Josh said, very excited. There's going to be the best of oncology Twitter. There's going to be oncology news, not just hazard ratios and p-values. And we're going to try and put together an image quiz. So if you would like to brush up on your radiology or pathology, then please subscribe at inquisitiveonc.com. That's inquisitiveonc.com.
Moving on from our sponsor. Thank you, Michael.
Our sponsor, which is us.
Amazing. So let's talk about this trial, which I'm really, really excited for. It's called the ALENA trial. I'm going to talk a bit about the background because I know we're already up to, well, outside how long we want to talk for. But as a just a bit of background about non-small cell lung cancer, so 50% of patients will receive an early stage lung cancer diagnosis. Primary treatment is surgery with adjuvant or neoadjuvant, as Michael so eloquently alluded to.
Not concisely, though.
Immunotherapy is coming into the fore in those that don't have targetable mutations, but what do you do for ALK? That's the thing. So we know recurrence rates are super high, and I mentioned this in my introduction, but for stage three, it's up to 76%, which is crazy. And the five-year survival rate is only 36% for stage three, specifically ALK mutated non-small cell lung cancers.
And the big problem with ALK, as anyone who's treated it will know, is it does have a huge predilection for the brain. So ALK positive recurrent disease has the potential to be nasty even by non-small cell lung cancer.
That's it. Michael already stole my little fact. So 60% of patients will have brain mets, and it only accounts for 4-5% of all non-small cell lung cancers. So immunotherapy is generally not used in the first line. There's not a lot of clinical evidence in the ALK cohort, but targeted therapy is wonderful. And as Michael's already spoken about the ADAURA trial, we know with EGFR adjuvant setting, there's some really good disease-free survival data out there. Reminder that stage 1B always seems across that confidence interval, which is a bit of a nebulous point, but it is a question as to will they benefit, and we need more data in respect to that. So designing this trial, it was a phase 3 open label, remember, open label randomized trial, and eligible patients were randomly assigned to 1-to-1 ratio to receive either oral alectinib at a dose of 600 milligrams twice a day, or intravenous chemotherapy for 4 cycles. They were stratified according to the disease stage, so 1B versus 2 versus 3A, and their race, so Asian versus non-Asian, and treatment with alectinib was given for 24 months or until recurrence, toxicity, withdrawal. 24 months, if you look at the discussion point, and I'm jumping ahead, they chose it purely because it was their idea of benefit versus toxicity in someone with this cohort, and I think a lot of the time, especially with immunotherapy, that's also sort of the standard. People had to be above the age of 18, histologically confirmed, and no prior systemic therapy. Endpoints, the key disease-free survival is the primary endpoint, and secondary endpoints are overall survival and safety. There was also an exploratory endpoint, which is CNS disease-free survival, and it had Thank you for nodding, Michael. I love that.
I'm nodding sagely over
here. It's very kind of you. And they were assessed every sort of 3 months for 2 years, and then the number of scans sort of spread out from there. So the median duration of follow-up was 27.8 months. There were 231 patients with stage 2 or 3A disease, 116 in the alectinib and 115 in the chemotherapy arm. 59 of those had disease recurrence or had died by the cutoff date, 14 in the alectinib arm and 34 in that chemotherapy arm. Disease-free survival in stage 2 and 2A at the 2 years, I think it's 3A, apologies, at the 2 years was 93.8% in the alectinib versus 63% in the chemotherapy arm. And at that 3 year mark, it was 88.3% in the alectinib arm versus 55.3% in the chemotherapy arm, with a hazard ratio for recurrence or death of 0.24. It's definitely going up there at the top of the hazard ratio list that we have in our heads.
The hazard ratio Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's literally like top tier. You know, yeah, how they're the fastest car, yeah, but it's the best hazard ratio. And so disease recurrence was seen in 15 patients in alectinib and 38.6% in the chemotherapy. Interesting. Sites of recurrence, Michael, really important question. Brain, 4 people in the alectinib and 14 people in the chemotherapy, and the hazard ratio of reducing recurrence or death with CNS recurrence was 0.22, favoring alectinib as the better drug. Overall survival has been immature, but there is a 2.2% event patient ratio. So essentially it's heading towards alectinib being the golden child.
The curves are starting to separate.
The curves. That's it. Demographics, which I'm kind of doing this a little bit backwards, but why not? Asian was about 50% in both arms. Pretty much there was no one of black or, I'm assuming, African-American, which is always a question with all these trials, with equity and access to trials.
I'm not really familiar, though, with how frequent ALK mutations are in the African or African-American population. The stereotypical patient is one of Asian descent, non-smoker, yeah, young female, all that sort of stuff. So it might also be a question of identification.
That's it. And, I mean, the thing to talk about, 40% was white. But obviously, we know there's a predilection for Asian populations as well. Mm. So that's still quite close considering that.
Yeah.
Median age was in the 50s and very much, apologies, yeah, median age was in the 50s. And most people were under the age of 65. It's also really, really interesting. When you look at the disease breakdown, 50%, give or take, a couple percentage points off with stage 3A, so obviously the highest risk of recurrence. And regional lymph nodes were seen in sort of almost 70 plus percent. So a lot of people had sort of lymph node recurrence. Histology type was favoring adenocarcinoma, and most patients underwent lobectomies as kind of the primary surgery, which is sort of understandable. And if you look at the beautiful, beautiful Kaplan-Meier curves, you know, the median disease-free survival was not reached in the alectinib, and 44.4 months, again, not reached in the chemotherapy arm. And in the intention to treat population, it was somewhat similar. When you look at the breakdown of the forest plot, that's what I really like to see. Very similar to previous ADAURA trials. Stage 1B, not a lot of patients, but across that confidence interval. Stage 2 and stage 3A, pretty strong indicators that there's a big benefit using adjuvant alectinib here. Really, really nice. And again, lymph nodes, it kind of benefited everyone, but mostly those of N2 disease. Moving on to safety, Michael, it has been a whirlwind. But it's all about the key points here. It's about the key points. Look, most people completed the treatment. Dose intensity was 99.4% in alectinib and 100% in chemotherapy. Common tox in the alectinib arm and was very much favoring CK levels increasing 43% and constipation in 42.2%. Chemotherapy saw nausea, decreased appetite, the classic chemotherapy arms. Moving on to the discussion. Because I think that's where this is the crux of this conversation is. It's a great drug, right? It's well tolerated. You know, those hazard ratios have blown us out of the water. There's still not overall survival, but we know disease-free survival is very much favoring the use of adjuvant alectinib. And there was a 76% lower risk of recurrence in this cohort. My discussion points today, Mikey, and you've kind of...
Great signposting there, Josh.
Thank you, thank you. I try so much for you. My discussion points today are as follows. Why was chemotherapy the control arm? I guess the question I can't answer is there are previous generation ALK inhibitors, which are probably not as well tolerated or as efficacious, but it would be interesting to see potentially, or even versus nothing. You know, with the benefit of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, it's not great. So I know it's blowing it out of the water, but I generally wouldn't recommend adjuvant chemotherapy anyway in most cases.
I guess practically speaking, up until this sort of data is coming, and it's the same sort of thing with EGFR, with ADAURA and NEO-ADAURA and all that sort of stuff, is that you wouldn't test.
Yeah, true.
If you had a non-small cell lung cancer, you might test for PD-L1,
yeah,
but you generally wouldn't do a full next generation sequencing because up until very recently...
That hasn't been widely available.
And it's been expensive where it has been. And so we didn't have any therapeutic options there anyway. So and I'm pretty sure we all would have done it. We might have given adjuvant chemotherapy unknowingly to a patient with ALK mutant non-small cell lung cancer.
Exactly.
We did do a quick literature review prior to recording, and there isn't really any evidence for an earlier ALK inhibitor such as crizotinib in the adjuvant space. I think ironically, there's a phase 3 investigator-led trial currently happening at Yale Medical Center for crizotinib. But otherwise, you know, it's been chemo or nothing.
Yeah, that's it. Well, you did take my other discussion point, which the rapid biomarker testing is required. So thank you for that. Other questions is 2 years the optimum duration of adjuvant therapy? Would it follow, you know, ADORA or the other trials?
ADORA, which is 3 years.
Which is 3 years. And that's the same in the lung, the breast cancer setting and adjuvant. Some are 2 years, some are 3 years.
Mm.
And I guess the other question to talk about is really, you know, this is all heterogeneous, right? So this is all saying that all the cells are sort of ALK mutated, you know, complete resections, those sorts of things. But it is an interesting space. And really looking at reducing recurrence of metastatic disease.
Yeah.
And this is what we need. Once someone's got metastatic disease in the solid organ cancer groups, it's really difficult to control because of that heterogeneity and that clonal differentiation you get in cancers.
Yeah. The other thing as well, because alectinib is not the only player in this space, it's not like osimertinib, which just has a monopoly over the EGFR space these days. There's also lorlatinib coming out, and, you know, hopefully for the CROWN trial in the metastatic setting, we'll have overall survival data soon, but we expect that to be positive. Will lorlatinib start making a play for the adjuvant ALK treatment space?
You know, I don't care, as long as the drugs are better and better.
Absolutely, but it will throw up interesting questions if we have alectinib and lorlatinib available in the early space, like we do currently in Australia with the metastatic space. What do you use? Because there's no head-to-head trials. As we keep on saying, please, people, if you're listening, make head-to-head trials. We need more of them.
That's it. So, Michael, what a fascinating episode. Some great
fascinating,
banter.
Fascinating, futuristic. It's just par for the course on this show. We aim for excellence aside from the construction noises outside. Apologies.
Yeah, so what are we doing next week?
Well, we've sort of reached a bit of a crossroads, I think, Josh, where we've done at least one episode on pretty much every tumor types, certainly the most common tumor types.
Sorry, sarcoma. You will come eventually.
You will come eventually, sarcoma. We have you in mind, but we need to do a lot of reading and talk to people who actually know about sarcoma. But we're going to start going back and looking at some of our old episodes and providing updates in critical spaces as to things that might have happened since we started doing this podcast coming up to 2 years ago, Josh. Can you believe it's been almost 2 years that we've been speaking into microphones like a bunch of idiots?
I know, but it's a good excuse to see you, so I'm very happy.
It's been good. It's got us through COVID. So we'll start where we started this podcast, with prostate cancer. And we'll have a look at a couple of trials that have come up since August of 2022. It's been a lot of studies happening in the intervening time. And we'll bring two of them to you next week. We hope to see you then.
Bye. I don't know why.
Thank you for listening to Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. This episode was produced by ADC Productions, with the assistance of education grants from Pfizer, Gilead Pharmaceuticals, and Merck Pharmaceuticals. However, we do not allow creative or editorial control or even early previews of any content. They are hearing this episode alongside you for the very first time. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, for all of our previous episodes, and make sure to subscribe to be the first to hear new content. If you'd like a particular topic covered on the show, or just want to chat, drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc, or by email on inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.